Okay.
This is the language that you probably got.
That's a lot of stuff to remember.
Yes. Well, that was
going
the
old in fact, I'm going to be meeting with Chris Nelson today.
I threw in some commas and so, the appropriation up here. Okay. And I'll take out, here, take this.
You want to talk to me too, so...
We'll call the Health and Human Services Division to order for Thursday, January 29th. We do have a quorum. Again, I don't think we'll take any votes. That's for coffee. That's the coffee fund. Passing money, Will. Well, okay. Just to orient members again... We are going to continue with DHS presentations today. We are going to spend all day on DHS. Tomorrow, Friday, we will devote entirely to the Department of Health. And this has been sent out on email, so folks should be aware, but for the record. Monday and Tuesday, we will be doing public testimony. We have already had more than we can fit in one day. You're never sure how long testimony is going to take. As is usually the case, there is some with concerns and some wishing to offer support for certain pieces. Of course, some that have support for pieces and concern about other pieces. One housekeeping measure, you may have noticed we're switching between sides every now and then. Every Thursday, we have to be in this room. The Senate only has three hearing rooms this year, and we're trying to shuffle around and try to keep everybody informed. So on Thursdays we'll be here. Other days that we have hearings will be across the hall. You know, if there's confusion, they're not too far away from each other. And kind of, we know our group pretty well. If you watch where they're going, you can probably find where we need to get. I know we are going to go till 11 o'clock again today. I've been told that Commissioner Jessen does have to leave by 10:45, so the last few minutes we'll have to do with staff and assistant commissioners, but that should be fine. And then next Wednesday, after public testimony on Monday and Tuesday, we will go over the boards and the councils as well. And that material has been added, the councils and the boards, to the back of the packet. We have the spreadsheet for DHS in members' packets. And with that, I think that's the housekeeping. We will continue where we left off. Yesterday, we got through a good piece of direct care and treatment with Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry, but there are, I don't know, five or six proposals left to cover, and so we'll start right up there. We will move into operations, cover health care today and continuing care. So with that, is Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry and Commissioner Jessen available? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And so I will dive into our Minnesota sex offender reform proposal that's in the governor's budget, and these change items are on pages 101 to 103 of your book. The first change item relates to making sure addresses county share. As most of you all are aware, there is a county share when for individuals committed to the sex offender treatment program. Right now, that county share applies to when they are in either Moose Lake or St. Peter. This would also make it clear that that county share also applies to clients who are on provisional discharge, so that the cost of, you know, of oversight of ongoing treatment for those individuals once they're on provisional discharge, there'll be a county share proposal for that as well. And that's just in now that we are starting to see the courts move forward and approve some provisional discharges. The second change item is really picks up where on many of the ideas that this committee got to know well. It was in Senator Sharon's bill from 2013 that passed the Senate. but adds a couple of things to that. So it would make sure that, as the Senate bill did 2 years ago, make sure that there are client evaluations and risk assessments of all clients at least every 2 years. And so there would be, 14 evaluators and risk assessors hired at DHS so that we can make sure that those thorough evaluations are done every 2 years. It will also provides for funding for the judicial branch. One of the challenges we have seen, and this has been the subject of, recommendations from the court-appointed experts as well as the sex offender task force from a couple of years ago, is that it's really taking too long for clients, once they are, apply for provisional discharge, to make it through the system. And a lot of that deals with the time at the what they call the SCAP, the Supreme Court Appeals Panel. So this proposal adds additional money for judges so that they can have more of those hearing days, so that these hearings will be completed in a more timely manner. Now, I must say, Mr. Chair, members, this is a number we put in based upon our best assessment. I did meet with the State Court Administrator and the Chief Judge of the SCAP and other judges, and have asked them for their input on what they think it would really take. They certainly are, the judges I spoke with in the State Court Administrator's office, very supportive of trying to just have more resources to handle these cases, because there are just a lot more of them now. On a quicker basis, I expect that they will come back with some refinements to this number, we look forward to that. But we wanted to have something in here in the governor's budget. This department is already, through a memorandum of understanding with the State Court Administrator's office, sending money to them to backfill for judges while they serve on the SCAP. But even with those additional SCAP panels, we're still doing this in a timely manner. And then finally, Mr. Chair, members, the governor's proposal also proposes that over the next couple of years, we create two less restrictive alternatives. We are in discussion with the governor's office about, assuming the governor's talked about a bonding bill, perhaps having those be part of that discussion as well. If I may, Mr. Chair, members, bring you a little up to date on that. I think that in the 2013 bill that passed the Senate, the Senate directed the commissioner to go and explore, and look into creating less restrictive alternatives. Since that time, as many of you all know, we did put out an RFP, first an RFI, then an RFP, to see what private providers would be willing to do, and we got a number of responses. And so we do And those responses enable us to really be able to deal with whether it's 3 or 4 a year or something like that, people that, at that level, maybe even 6 or 7 a year, if the Supreme Court Appeals Panel decides to provisionally discharge those folks. But there were some gaps. We didn't have anyone step up and say that they would be willing to provide care for what I think of the nursing home or assisted living, the medically needy clients. Evaluators from the OLA to the Sex Offender Task Force to now these court-appointed experts have all identified basically three groups of clients that the experts would say could be in a less restrictive alternative. Those, first and foremost, are the medically needy people in wheelchairs and walkers and, have serious health needs. Another are cognitively limited clients. And then another would be a group that of clients that were committed based upon what they did in juveniles, so no adult offenses. So, especially because the groups, the medically needy and the individuals who were committed based upon juvenile offenses, we have not had people step forward on the private sector side to say they were interested in serving those clients. We think we would need to do that ourselves. And so this provides for some initial operating expenses, because while I think in the long term it's not going to be any more expensive and should be a little less expensive, perhaps, to serve clients outside of the razor wire in these secure, less risk alternatives. At first, during this transition, it's going to cost money, because we're continuing to have to pay for Moose Lake and St. Peter while we're creating these. So the dollars reflect that. So the proposal anticipates that over the next 2 years, it at least has a plan for if the courts did agree to provisionally discharge or transfer people, that really assuming that the most we'd be talking about would be 50. Now, this, may I say, Mr. Chair, members, is outside of what the federal judge may or may not do. None of this is some of this is the direction of experts he has appointed, but I'm not saying, this is what I think a federal court would do or would not do. This is what we think is, the right reform based upon what the OLA and other experts have suggested, and after we've done our due diligence to figure out what the private sector would be willing to step forward and do. And we chose the number 50 thinking that there are probably between 150 and 200 clients at MSOP that fall into one of those three groups. But on the other hand, it takes time to build, find placements, and for people to make it through the court system. And, of course, none of these people would be transferred or provisionally discharged unless the courts approved it. Unless we have places, when the courts do approve this, we put ourselves in jeopardy unless we have some alternatives which, while less restrictive than MSOP at Moose Lake, are, we believe, secure and provide both for the treatment, ongoing treatment for clients and for the safety of the public. So we think that at least planning for this is the prudent thing to do.
Excellent. Senator Sharon has a question. One of the things you talked about the 50 clients, I think that, as I was reading this, we did ask about is it 50 over the biennium or is it 50 a year? It says in the sheet 50 a year, and I think that was not quite what you're trying to do with this proposal. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's exactly right. I apologize for that was not clear. But we were really projecting this is what we need to be able to if the courts provisionally discharge 50 over the next 2 years.
Yeah.
And that was kind of our planning, not 50 a year.
Yep. Senator Sharon?
Thank you very much. Commissioner, I think this is great that the governor is providing leadership on creating investments in those things that the court's own task force recommended that we do. The Senate has already approved them. There's a clear indication from the court's development of that commission and direction to that task force as to where the questions the court had given us a hint, about what might be in our best interest. So I'm glad to see the governor take an important role. And it's nice to see that this can be done with our help funding it with an administrative lead on it. The one question is one of the things that you did not include that was in our bill was this panel that reviews before people are moved into the facility, which the treatment of offenders in the Department of Human Services for treatment once they finish their time is very expensive, and it really does consume, if we don't change this, more and more. If people just come in and don't go out, it eats more and more of our budget here that we need for other things because it just keeps growing. So there was a proposal in that bill to review anybody coming out of Department of Corrections at the state level before it goes to the county, where there's a lot of pressure on county attorneys to do things and they're elected, to advise counties about whether or not that person, in fact, is best treated in behind the perimeter or in a less restrictive alternative or just stay within the correction system. That's not included here. Can you help me understand why you would not also do that as well? Or would that be corrections' responsibility?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I supported that and testified in favor of that in your bill. So the fact that it's not included here is not to say that we do not think that task force idea is a good one. I do think that there was some overlap with corrections we need to address. This is a starting place for hopefully a starting place where we can have a conversation about reforming the system. I think there are a number of other good ideas in the task force recommendations, which are not here as well. And I think the governor has been open about saying that, you know, he is open to hearing about, you know, further ideas.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. That, Chairman. I just, my point is, and then I'll leave it alone, is our committee cares about this, how much money is expended and keeps growing and taking more out of this budget because they've transferred this obligation over to DHS to fund, and it just grows. It doesn't go down, and it's very expensive. So I'm hoping that we're successful at supporting these kinds of reforms.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Sharon. It is something we have spent a great deal of time on and will until we can do better. From my perspective as the chair of this, I do think that if we were going to fund that, I would hope it would be at least a blend with corrections to get that input, that the intake correct. And there were serious issues around variation around the state. But some of the conversation and some of the things that we had done had sort of changed the commitment patterns that happened. They were going down for a while. Do you have an update as to what the commitment patterns around the state are right now? Are we seeing as many commitments as we used to, and what are we expecting in the future? Do you have that?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have the exact numbers, others may, but I do know over the last 2 years that we have, you know, we've seen the number of commitments taper off.
Mm-hmm.
I think we projected originally it would be kind of 50 to 55 is my recollection a year. That was what we were projecting.
Yep.
And so while we continue to see commitments, we have not seen as many in the last couple of years. I think it's too, our forecast folks say it's too early to decide if that's kind of a pattern we can count on or not.
Right. Okay. That's helpful. And then one question you probably can't answer right now, but as we get into budget a little deeper, when I was looking at the county share piece, I scratched my head a little bit and wondered why there would be savings attributed to this, because I didn't think we really had a plan to be doing provisional discharges, and so I wouldn't think there would be money in the forecast assumed to be coming from counties to actually produce savings when we do this reform and have additional people in provisional discharges. So that's a little bit in the weeds, but as we get deeper in and look at and bear this out, that's just one of the notes I have on my sheet. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real briefly, Commissioner, on the very last line on page 101, it says that because of this uncertainty, the proposal is a one-time appropriation until 2019. This will be reviewed, I would assume, every year, and we will be looking at and making sure that we can capture the savings if there are any.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions of members? All right. Commissioner Jessen, I see Commissioner Berry.
So, Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to ask Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry to come and walk us through the detail on the security hospital deficiency, which I do not believe we've talked with this committee about, and we want to make sure we answer any questions you have.
And
about
we do have a hearing scheduled on that in full finance, just for the committee's information. The history with deficiency bills is that given their tight timeline, we don't send the bill itself to divisions, but I did indicate to the finance chair, Cohen, that we did want to actually discuss the proposal here in HHS. We don't have the bill before us. That is scheduled for Monday in full finance. And so we'll have a hearing on that, but we will hear the proposal here, and any comments we have I can carry into finance. There's a few of us on finance as well. Deputy Commissioner Berry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Ann Berry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. The budget page I'll be referring to is page 105, and then the slide behind me provides an outline of the things that contributed to the deficiency in the Minnesota Security Hospital Program. In December, we were in front of Senator Sharon's policy committee providing an update on the conditions on our license and the actions we were taking to respond to the conditions that were placed on our license. The first condition was in 2011, December, the very end of calendar year 2011. It was followed by an extension of our condition in August of 2013, and then finally In May of 2014, just last year, a final extension of the condition on the license about a year ago today, following the death of a client at the hands of another client. So there has been a long history of conditions on our license, and these activities are all associated with responding to those conditions. So the first thing we did was to add 59 staff. These are unit staff, mostly security counselors. These are people who are directly engaged with clients on the unit. We were using something called protective isolation. That meant we were, before we even saw assaultive behavior, but saw a pattern that would possibly lead to it, we were putting people into and separating them from the rest of the population. We were prohibited from doing so. As a way really to create a more therapeutic environment, we added a lot of staff to our unit. 60 staff is a lot of staff. We know that, but we needed to really add people to the unit so they were engaging with and working with clients and no longer using protective isolation. That was our first response. Then our second response to the condition that was added to the license just last May was to add highly specialized staff, and these are staff who could provide the clinical expertise, support, coaching, mentoring for our staff, for the additional staff, and for the staff who have always worked in our facility, so that they would take an approach that was really trauma-informed, recovery-informed, and person-centered. It's a word you're going to hear us talk about a lot. It's the language of the court in the Jensen settlement. But what it means is that we directly engage with clients in their recovery and use all of the positive supports we can to, in fact, advance recovery for the people that we're serving. So we added another 18 staff, again, specialized clinical staff in the last biennium. Or I'm sorry, in this biennium. There were two more things that we have done. One is to add security cameras on all of the units. We had some security cameras in hallways, but what we really needed were more security cameras on the units to promote a safer environment for staff. This was one of the recommendations of staff. We think it's an excellent recommendation and have added all of these security cameras on every one of our units. And finally, although we did receive money for a bonding proposal last session, and we are grateful, we are underway in building and remodeling our facility, we couldn't wait any longer to create an admissions unit. It's something we had wanted to do for a long time. We were holding off waiting for the bonding proposal. We just didn't feel we could wait any longer. There are times when we need to separate clients from one another. Many of our clients don't handle large 20 to 25 person units. There are times when they need a 2 or 3 person unit. So this admissions unit is not seen at all as a punitive response. It is really a therapeutic response to people who don't do well in large therapeutic environments. So we went ahead, remodeled space that we had, so we now have a small admissions unit. Going forward, when the new facility is constructed, we will have 2 admissions units and a crisis unit. So we will have a lot more capacity to be flexible. But we went ahead, did this remodeling. We just didn't feel we could wait any longer. So those are the 4 pieces on the top of the slide there that contribute to the $10.4 million deficiency request that's in front of you. In addition to that, there are a number of other pressures that have been placed on our budget. We've added staff in other programs. We have upgraded our electronic record system. We had a very, very outdated system and would not have met any of the state or federal requirements for meaningful use and systems that work. We also, there were costs associated with the Jensen settlement that have been borne out of our base budget. We've been handling them out of our direct care and treatment budget. We really no longer can sustain that over the long term. And there is, a companion budget proposal from the governor for the permanent funding of the Jensen office, but we've been carrying that. So there's a number of deficiencies also below the line that we want you to know that, in fact, the $10.4 million is only a portion of the full deficiency, but we are doing everything we can to manage the rest of the deficiency, and the request from the governor is $10.4 million.
Questions of members? All right. I think that wraps up direct care and treatment, is that correct? And we'd move on to Chuck Johnson with Operations. Deputy Commissioner, welcome. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chuck Johnson. I serve as Deputy Commissioner for Policy and Operations for the Department of Human Services. I'm going to take you through a couple of slides here. The first one really relates to what we're calling must-have proposals. We use that terminology to categorize them in this way. These are mostly proposals that are required, changes we are required to do because of changes in federal law. And so the items that we need to move forward on have obviously a budget impact to them because of changes in federal law. Mr. Chair, the first page is page 107. This is a change in child support. This is a conformity to the Affordable Care Act changes, which affected the child support program. There are three changes here. We're asking for $92,000. That's for the system's costs related to these changes. The first is essentially changing the status of the Minnesota Care Program changes under federal law now that it is a basic health plan and no longer considered part of the Medicaid program. And that results in a change in how we handle requirements for child support cooperation for recipients of the Minnesota Care Program going forward. The second change is a change that essentially streamlines the way that a child support order is adjusted when there's a change that is only in the health care portion of the child support order. So sometimes child support orders include what's called a medical order, which essentially says how the parents are going to provide coverage for the kids given whatever kind of health insurance access they have individually. And this streamlines the process so when there's a change, we don't have to go back through the court and change the entire order. We can make the change more simply going forward. And then the final change following the changes in federal law is that the federal law now eliminates the obligation of a non-custodial parent from cooperating with child support when the non-custodial parent is on medical assistance and the children are on medical assistance, which essentially is a recognition that in the instance where that non-custodial parent is on medical assistance, they don't have a lot of income, they're relying on MA for their coverage already, and so the process doesn't make as much sense for child support enforcement.
I think this is first change proposal that will require us to carry this through judiciary. Just a side comment.
It's good to see it twice.
Mr. Chair, the next proposal is on page 110. This one is actually not a federal change. This is a change that's resulted from consultation with the Department of Commerce and the Minnesota Joint Underwriters Association. Since 1977, the Department of Human Services has provided insurance for foster care providers. And these are home foster care, adult and children foster care providers. And this is essentially to provide that coverage for them so that there is a way for a group essentially to get the group value of having all those providers together and not have it built into the foster care rate or handled in some other way. With our discussions with the Department of Commerce and the joint underwriters, they've identified that given the claims that are coming through, they need a significant increase in the premiums in order to provide that coverage. It's about a $500,000 a year impact. There's an offset for federal reimbursement that puts it at the $333,000 that you see here. And obviously the concern here is that if we're not able to provide adequate coverage, that will affect whether or not people are willing to become and be foster care providers. And so we think it's important that we have the resource to provide the adequate coverage so that we can attract people to be foster care providers for adults and children.
Deputy Commissioner, what is the level of liability that is provided to foster parents through these policies?
Mr. Chair, it is damages would be, so injury caused by a foster parent would be $250,000 per occurrence or $1 million on an aggregate limit, so that's the level of coverage. And for an injury, alleged neglect would be $250,000 with a million limit as well.
And that's, we'd like to keep those limits, and the claims have risen to the point
that's
where
correct.
You can't keep it within the current premiums. Okay. Commissioner Jessen?
If I may just add something here, Mr. Chair, members, many of you all know we are struggling to be able to
Absolutely.
Attract and retain good foster parents. So we think this is just critical from a policy perspective.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 111. This relates to two changes that are part of the 2014 federal law called Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act. The first piece of it is a change that requires us to do some tracking of children who run away from foster care. And this is part of the act that is really looking at the sex trafficking, and they're trying to, the federal government is trying to essentially use the existing data collections that states have under our adoption and foster care systems as a way to try to track kids so that when we're looking across state and nationwide to try to identify where sex trafficking is going on, we have another methodology to use or place to go to find information that might be helpful to finding children who may be being exploited. And that results in a change needed in our social service information system, and the cost on that is $52,000. The second piece is another child support change, and this is a change that essentially requires us to offer income withholding notices to employers. So employers have a person in their payroll who's providing child support, and there's income withholding going on. We have to provide those notices both on paper and electronically. We currently only do it on paper. We have to do it electronically. There's a systems cost there in the PRISM system of about $150,000.
And then on page 112 of this, I think there's a whole block of text that doesn't belong in this section. As I was reading it, it threw me for a loop. Starting with the child support piece. Is that part of this?
Mr. Chair, the child support piece is part of this.
Because it was also in that whole block of text was in the child support.
Oh, is it the same text?
It's the same text, and it's the same measures, and I didn't really see the connection.
Well, Mr. Chair, the measures that are presented there are the five standard child support measures that the federal government uses that we measure our success on. So my guess is that the results were put in because both pages had child support changes to them. We use the same result measures across the two pages.
It does belong in both places.
I believe it does, Mr. Chair.
I struggled with it a little bit.
Mr. Chair, it's sort of a funny page because the two issues don't really fit together, but they were both in the same federal legislation.
Okay. Senator Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that we're spending money to document the runaways and the sex trafficked youth. I'm assuming we are, but are we spending any money in Minnesota to go after the people who are hiring and paying for the adults who are paying for sex with youth who are being put in these terrible situations? Can you tell me how much, if anything, we're spending on that?
Commissioners?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I do not, as I'm sitting here, know the exact numbers we're spending on that. I do know that in forget the title of it, but the legislature in, I believe it was 2013.
Safe Harbor.
Passed the Safe Harbor Law, which did a lot of good work on sex trafficked youth, including stiffening the penalties for people who participated who were really the perpetrators of the sex trafficking. So stiffer penalties for them. At the same time, we try and find more supports for those usually teenagers who are sex trafficked. So I do know that there were provisions of the law specifically addressing that problem.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, this proposal says it makes a one-time upgrade to the SSIS, enabling the county workers to document this sex trafficking figure. Have we got a figure on, is the SSIS up to snuff? Is it appropriate for everything that we need to do, especially with the task force on child protection? Is there more that needs to be done with that system?
Sure. I'm Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen. I think that's part of something we would need to review as part of looking at the recommendations for the Child Protection Task Force. But I would say we are in the process of a system modernization project, and as part of that, SSIS is part of that view of trying to look at what do we need going forward in the system in order to adequately support the work that we do in the child protection system, as well as in other areas that SSIS currently supports. I think that it's generally viewed as being a really good system for managing cases, but I think sometimes caseworkers are frustrated with the amount of data they need to enter into it. So I think that may be part of the balancing act that we need to get to in looking forward.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, the next three pages have to do with changes for compliance on our publicly funded health care programs. I'm going to ask Assistant Commissioner Nathan Morocco to present on these pages.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nathan Morocco, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. As Deputy Commissioner Johnson mentioned, I'll be covering three items, the first related to long-term care and then a couple related to our public health programs, one for Minnesota Care and one for MA. So the first piece, referencing page 113, this has to do with the treatment of long-term care assets. This is really resulting from an Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. This is Justin versus Anderson, and it really has to do with the treatment of assets and how they are calculated for purposes of eligibility in our long-term care programs. This will result in less spend down on behalf of the clients or their community spouse, resulting in earlier eligibility into the long-term care program. So overall, then, that would have a cost of $5.2 million in fiscal year 16 and 17 and $15.1 million in 18 and 19.
Senator Carlson, you may recognize this proposal.
Mm-hmm. Yes. AARP.
This was a bill before us last year that Senator Carlson brought to us, and we welcome the change.
Right. Mr. Chair, then, moving on to page 115. This is a Minnesota Care federal compliance package. There's a few elements in here, but let me direct you to, I think, a couple of important ones, specifically the ones that have cost elements to them. The first would be adjusting the premiums to comply with federal regulations. These are minor adjustments, typically a dollar or two, and it's usually it's the 150% or lower range. And this is just to come into compliance with federal law. So as an example, those folks under 35% of the federal poverty level will be exempted from any premium. So that's an example of one of the changes that's occurring. Another one is that we are required to implement a 30-day grace period. Today, we currently have a 20-day grace period. So as a result of the extra 10 days, there may be some additional unclaimed premiums or premiums that we're unable to get from the clients as a result of that small extension. So the dollars as a result of those two are $732,000 in fiscal year 16 and 17 and $611,000 in fiscal year 18 and 19. There are other compliance components that don't necessarily have costs associated with them. As an example, we will be renewing under MA January 1st for all of the enrollees in Minnesota Care. This is to sync up with what's occurring through MNsure, through the qualified health plans, so that when folks are going in and shopping for products, they will, in essence, have the same open enrollment period and cycle as those that might be shopping through the QHP. So that's one example. There's some repeal of some outdated provisions, and then some clarity around income or... yes, Mr. Chair.
They have they will have the renewal set at January 1st,
not
the open enrollment period. There is not an open enrollment period. It's open all year round.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the clarity. Yes, renewal period.
Yep.
Correct. So so we will have the existing renewal periods in MA. That's the month that you come in. That is your renewal period. But for the basic health plan or Minnesota Care, the renewal period will be January 1st.
Excellent. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering what will be the balance in the Health Care Access Fund in 2018-2019. Somebody could please tell me that.
This is actually, just so we know, this is a fairly technical change. There is a larger change to the Minnesota Care later on where we can get in more detail. This is to bring it in compliance with federal law, but at the end of 18 and 19, with the entire package proposed by the governor, the healthcare access fund is balanced at the end of 17 and has a $73 million deficit at the end of 18-19.
Mr.
And again, we will have a more detailed package proposal about other changes. Senator Benson.
Just to clarify, because there were several proposals yesterday that also accessed the health care access fund, so your balance and then $73 million deficit includes everything, including the loan forgiveness proposals that are moving forward from the Department of Health?
The healthcare access fund sheet that I found on the administration's website, I believe, is inclusive of all of the proposals put forward by the governor that spend and save healthcare access fund, and the net effect of the governor's entire package is to balance the healthcare access fund at the end of 16-17, and it leaves a $73 million deficit at the end of 19. And we can make copies of this.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the last piece then is a compliance component on the MA side. This would be page 118, and again, I would direct you to some of the specifics where there's a cost component. And again, these are compliance changes. One would be removing the cost sharing for preventative services. So as an example, smoking cessation would be an example where there would be no copay or co-insurance related for those types of programs. It also removes cost sharing for American Indians, again, as required under federal law. And it removes cost sharing for breast and cervical cancer control program. So in aggregate, these have a cost of $200,000 in fiscal year 16 and 17 and $210,000 in fiscal year 18 and 19. There are some other technical changes, a couple that I would draw your attention to. One would be an alignment or a clarity around how to bill for lab services. This is where some entities were billing for lab services that they were not directly providing. This just makes it clear that only the providers who provide the service are allowed to bill us directly. And then there's also some updates on federal citations that were just out of date. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that completes the three updates on the compliance side.
Okay. Any questions of members? Commissioner Jessen?
Mr. Chair, next we'll talk about the increased funding request for the Minsure IT development and operating costs that's allocated to DHS. And while Deputy Commissioner Johnson will walk through at a high level, I would ask if we could have CEO of Minsure, since these are really join us as well, because Minsure probably has more answers to some of these committee's questions.
That'd be helpful.
Saw Scott earlier.
Mr. Chair, the page 120 in your books, as Commissioner said, this covers the DHS share of Minsure operations and Minsure IT development. For the 16-17 biennium, it's about $10.5 million for IT and $1.1 million for the operations side. There's a lot of moving pieces fiscally in 16-17. If you look out to 18-19, it kind of evens out to be about $3 million a year for operations and $3.5 million a year for IT across the Health Care Access Fund and General Fund changes. Mr. Chair, the just a little background that I think the committee is familiar with but may not be top of mind as to why DHS has a share in these development. Basically, under federal rules, there is something called a cost allocation process that it looks at benefiting programs. Anywhere where there is a federal expenditure being made that results in a benefit to a program, there needs to be allocated cost to that program. So in the case of Minsure, any activity either on the operations side or on the IT side that benefits medical assistance or benefits Minnesota Care is allocated essentially to DHS for our share of it. Now, of course, in the case of medical assistance, we get a significant significant amount of Medicaid federal reimbursement that also then offsets that cost, so the state share becomes relatively small. But that's the process that we go through in terms of identifying how those budget items for IT development and miniature operations get allocated. You'll also recall that DHS was allocated or appropriated funding in the 2013 legislative session for these activities. And so this is really an increase in that appropriation, identifying changes that have happened since we did the fiscal note in 2013. The primary change that has resulted since we did that fiscal in 2013 is a much different proportion of cases being served through the miniature IT system than we had anticipated initially. The fiscal note in 2013 assumed that about two-thirds of the cases would be public program cases, and in reality, we're looking at about 91% when we get out to fiscal 16. And that metric is a primary driver of how cost allocation is done. Essentially, the feds allow you to use different metrics, but for this kind of a purpose, that's a standard metric to look at. That's how you figure out which program is benefiting. We've also done some more significant work around the cost allocation, looking at the miniature operations. Again, a lot changed from how we have played out the operational side of this program from what we might have expected back in 2013 before we had even started the first open enrollment. And we tried to reflect those changes as well, which resulted in these increases.
Commissioner Jessen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may just add kind of one global comment about why getting the IT right in the IT system, we think of as miniature, is so important to the department and to the counties that work on human services. You know, people talk a lot about kind of miniature, but we're really, the way I think about it, there are two things. There's kind of miniature, the business entity, and there's an IT system, which people also call miniature. And that IT system is really what we want to be to serve as our integrated human services IT system going forward. That our long-term vision is to have one place where clients can go and find out if they're eligible and enroll in our public programs. We're dealing with healthcare now. We're looking at this as a platform. A platform which will be better for clients and much better for the many state and county workers that now are having to use a variety of old and antiquated systems. So, I know that I have at the miniature board meetings and other places raised concerns about the amount that is allocated to DHS. I do think on the IT side, we need all of those IT dollars to try and improve this system so that it works better. And it can be that vehicle, which I believe it can be, which will fundamentally change kind of our human services delivery system moving forward. And some of that, I mean, most of that you all are aware of, some of that gets lost in kind of the discussions around MNsure. But I think that is why. But I would ask the committee to think about that bigger picture, which I know from the counties and from our perspective, we are certainly keeping kind of in the front of our minds.
Well, and I know that core functionality of the eligibility module itself has been one that we've really struggled with. How is that module itself coming along? And whichever one of you is most appropriate to answer that.
I will give my view on that, but I'm sure these gentlemen could correct me and
yes.
build upon this. But I think we're at a point where and this is the kind of IBM Quorum software that's making eligibility determinations. And while we struggled with that on the rollout and had to make a lot of changes, that is, overall, those eligibility determinations for people on public programs, that is working pretty well. I mean, so I'm encouraged by that. Having said that, you have to have it work. You have to have the right information in there, and those are some of the challenges. So if it's a struggle to have a life event change entered into the system, with someone's has their income changes, their address, even their address changes, but also mostly income or household members, if it's hard to get that in there, then the fact that it makes then the eligibility decisions aren't correct if that information isn't in there. But I do think that core eligibility making functionality is much improved over where it was, but I don't think it would surprise any of you for me to say, oh my goodness, we have a lot of work to do. I mean, Chuck, do you have a different view of this?
I just add to that, I think what the commissioner was describing is correct. The initial eligibility determination process works quite well. it's really what happens when you get into managing the case on the back end. We have more of the challenges, and it's the life changes and the other processes the counties need. And I think why that's particularly important to us on the public program side is because, as you mentioned before, we have open enrollment all year round. We have a population that churns and changes a lot, and that case management process matters a lot. It doesn't matter as much on the QHP side where they're enrolling for a year and the change, and it's more or less a stable population. So that's why it plays through for us as being really critical that we continue to get those improvements in place, and that particularly is a strong focus of our work.
And then we got a couple of questions. The investment from, you know, the additional investment from the feds, this investment from DHS, do we feel pretty confident that we'll have the technological backbone when we get through this to have a good platform moving forward? Maybe Mr. Leitz or...
Mr. Chair, for the record, Scott Leitz. I'm with the CEO at Minsure. With the additional investments that are being made, both from the new federal funds that are coming in, are going to allow us to be able to make a number of the changes that Commissioner Jessen just talked about. I think those were on the docket to be made, but the advantage of being able to bring additional resources here will allow us to accelerate that work. I think one of the biggest challenges that we've had, as the Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner noted, the front-end portion of this works pretty well now. Most people are able to come and get a clean determination and go through. Where we still do not have good processes is on the back end. And what I mean by that is the ability to, for county workers, for example, to more cleanly manage cases or just to manage cases, for information to be more cleanly transferred to health plans and so forth. So a lot of the focus of the next phase of this build-out is really in those back-end areas to ensure that we're able to complete the processes in a much cleaner way than we are now.
Excellent. Senator Brown?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question would be to any of the testifiers. For the Minsure systems development and operations, how much federal and state money has been budgeted to date for this operations, and how much has been spent to date?
CEO Leitz, everybody seems to be looking at you.
Mr. Chair, I'm somewhat used to that. Mr. Chair and Senator, to date, we have received approximately, I'm doing the math in my head real quickly here, 150 plus the 30, 180 some odd million dollars for the build out. Now, not all of that has been expended to that point. I may need to follow back around with the committee to get you the exact figures in terms of what the expenditures are, but in terms of the federal money that's been received, it's in that range.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Mr. Leitz, do you feel that, can you give me a percentage of that 180 million? And I understand that's an estimate. A percentage of what you think has been spent to date?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, I would estimate somewhere in the range of 75%, something in that area.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Benson had a question. Senator Rosen's coming up.
Thank you, Senator Mr. Chair. Benson. It's really more of a comment than a question. The eligibility system that resides in Minsure should exist to serve more than Minsure, and therefore it is inappropriate that it resides at Minsure, and I would suggest we discuss seriously as a policy moving eligibility to an independent agency so the counties have more of a voice at the table, DHS is treated fairly, and the Minsure Board is not driving our eligibility IT decision-making. They have not shown competence in managing this process. The $34 million that we received from the feds would have been sufficient to build an eligibility system in Minnesota that had been proven and tested in states that had successful Minsure rollouts. And so I guess my question for Mr. Leitz is, are you going to continue to build a patchwork solution for eligibility? Mr. Chair and members, I liken it to a train rolling down the tracks, and Curum and Minsure have said, okay, we need a trestle, let's just build it as fast as we can, and it is not working as we need it to work. And so, Mr. Leitz, I would like to know if that $34 million is going to be spent patchworking eligibility or getting a solution that has been proven to work.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, the additional build-out here is to do two things. The first is to continue to make the changes that will allow the system to be more seamless than it is right now. That does include things like having the ability for county workers and others to manage cases in the system. It also would enable brokers and agents and others to have direct enrollment into the system in a way that they don't currently have, a portal, if you will, to be able to do that, as well as a number of other changes that relate to the eligibility determination, particularly as it relates to Minnesota Care and the Medicaid program. There's also a larger strategic question here around whether there are ways that we could continue to make sure that we have a good eligibility platform, but thinking about ways that we can potentially streamline the qualified health plan side of this, meaning the portion that relates to commercial enrollment. And we are looking at ways to potentially do that. Those are larger strategic questions that aren't necessarily handled directly by this federal money, but I think get to the sort of the future several years of the plan.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Leitz, are you building in things that have been tested and proven to work in other states? Or are you going to continue this ad hoc approach of let's build it and try it out in Minnesota first? Because there are states that built successful exchanges. There's enough to learn from now. We're no longer at the cutting edge. We are lagging behind, and we are spending a tremendous amount of money. And I want to know, has it been built, tested, and proven in other states, or are you going it on your own?
CEO Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, we're continuing at this point in time to build on the system that is there. It has a stable system. It's been Deloitte, when they looked at the system, said it was a stable, good system to build on. What's being added now are those elements that we think are necessary for getting good eligibility determinations and a continued improvement in the enrollment.
We've got a few more.
Mr. Chair, I know, and I could take a week with Mr. Leitz, but
we're not going to do that.
I know. So, Mr. Leitz, what states, what exchanges have your builds been tested in?
Ms. CEO Leitz?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, could you repeat the question?
These new builds.
Senator Benson.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
That's good.
These builds, these changes, what states have they been tried in, and have they succeeded in those states? Name the states and tell me if they've succeeded.
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, each state took a different approach in terms of the build-outs, and each state has had its own challenges in terms of the rollouts of any of the exchanges. So all of them were new when they came up, and all of them have had unique challenges as they've come up. There is not a single state that has had 100% success in rolling one of these exchanges out. So our exchange, we share a platform. The District of Columbia also has the approach that we're taking. They've had success in what they've been doing. It's a stable, good platform to build on, and one that we think is going to allow us to move forward on much of the integration that the commissioner talked about earlier.
CEO Leitz, I think one of the things you've described to us in the past is that the vendor that you brought in to do the end-to-end review has actually had pretty decent success helping other states get through it, and that's one of the reasons you chose that vendor. Is that correct? I mean, maybe that would add some insight into this line of inquiry, if I could get an answer to my question, and then we'll come back to you, Senator
Benson.
Maybe
he'll answer you more directly than he answered me, but I would like the opportunity to follow up.
Senator, Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct.
And
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, they built Kentucky and Connecticut, did eligibility first, made their exchange work within a full eligibility system. Yeah. Maryland, which mirrored our model, or we mirrored Maryland, they were happening simultaneously, abandoned their system and went to the Connecticut model. I want to make sure we're not throwing good money after bad. The Minshew Board appears to have its feet stuck in the mud when it comes to doing strategic change, and I would like to make the point that this money should not be spent until we see specific strategic direction from the Minshew Board on how they're going to fix this.
You know, one of the points you made is one of the things I talk about Kentucky's experience, actually, Having it be a state agency is one of the proposals that I'm suggesting to try to actually try to get at some of these issues. And as I have read some of the national literature, one of the big advantages that Kentucky saw was the ability to better integrate the entirety of their enrollees through the exchange, both the private side and the public side. And, you know, I think that having it in a state agency model, and I don't mean to, you know, sidetrack us or anything, but it is that very experience that you're talking about that's led me to try to propose some things in this, you know, difficult environment. Yeah. Did you have a question there? Should I turn it over to CEO Leitz, or should we?
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Leitz isn't going to answer me about the testings and provability of the changes that they're making, so I will end my questioning. I appreciate the accommodation. Thank you.
Absolutely. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Leitz, I think we probably need just a little more clarification to Senator Brown's question. I think that was a little vague. And if you could give us more detailed in writing the cost breakdown of the federal share and of the state share. And I'm just a little confused here. I mean, this is a big chunk of money with no FTEs, I see. So $1.172 million is going to DHS for ongoing business operation cost. And $10.5 million to develop the MNsure IT system. I'd like to know how much the state has put into MNsure, a breakdown. And then can you explain, you know, and what the federal and the state share and the ongoing cost. And then can you explain why you need $1.1 million for staff with an extra increase in FTEs?
Senator Rosen, maybe you could help.
The recommendations right at the top, the first paragraph.
No. I don't see FTEs there, though.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, there's $1.1 million for DHS with no FTEs.
Okay.
That's, and I'd just like to know.
No, I'm trying to just make sure I understand so I can follow the answer.
Yeah, yep. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I kind of threw out a lot there. But I'm just kind of confused where this money is going.
Sure.
And what we have already spent, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Jessen, looked like you had some insights.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, my understanding is that this is just basically allocating to DHS a larger cost of the ongoing FTEs that are in MNsure, so that they have a number of FTEs that do things, you know, kind of management, project management, communications, you know, call centers. And so because of the change in, so it's, I mean, CEO Leitz can talk about it. Are they increasing FTEs? I don't know. But what I do know is that they're increasing the amount that the Department of Human Services is charged or allocated for those FTEs. And I think, and Deputy Commissioner Johnson, correct me if I'm wrong, it's now on average, what, 70% of the management? So 70% of the management costs going forward would be paid by the Department of Human Services under this proposal. And if you look at ongoing on the IT side, because our public enrollees would be 91%, I believe DHS would be cost allocated under this 91% of the going forward IT costs.
Right. So the sheet before us says 65% for MNsure operations. Is it 65?
Yes, I apologize. The numbers, we redid the cost allocation and they made it a little more precise
than what
I saw it last time.
Just
sorry,
trying
Mr.
To,
Chair.
To track. Okay. Senator Rosen, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. We have 11.6 for this in FY 16-17 and 13 million in 18 and 19. And we just need to get our hands around this money a little bit better.
Yep, I agree. We have Senator Brown and Senator Hayden. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Leitz, I'd also like to follow up with what Senator Rosen has just asked. I would like it if this committee could receive a breakdown of the money that has been spent, roughly that 75%, and I realize that's an estimate, of where that money has gone, how it's been spent, and then of the 25% or so that hasn't been spent, where is that designated to be spent? I'd like to see what the cost drivers are. This seems like a very large number to me, and it's hard to wrap your head around $180 million, but It went somewhere, and I'd just like to have an understanding of how that money was used. Is that something you could provide to this committee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, happy to do that.
Great. Senator Hayden?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to kind of belabor the point, but I was intrigued on Senator Benson's kind of line of questioning, and then, frankly, when I listened to Commissioner Jetson talk about what's happening, as you move forward, how can we be assured that you're not going to make the same mistakes that you made in the past? How can we be assured that with the new revenue that we'll actually get it right? I think that's what I heard Senator Benson saying. So with that, I also think about Commissioner Jetson saying that it is really important for us to get it right beyond good fiscal responsibility and making sure where we know where the money goes, as my colleagues are talking about. But we want to build this platform, this big eligibility platform, based on what we're doing and moving forward, because we know that our eligibility platforms today are archaic and simply can't continue to move forward. So when I start to try to put that together, I'm trying to figure out, one, how can we be sure that what we're doing, we're going to do it right? We spent a lot of money to this point and haven't gotten the outcomes that we've been looking for. Secondly, I guess I'm thinking about Commissioner Jessen. If that is the case and we are going to use this platform, eligibility platform, for all of our eligibility issues, and if I look at the cost allocation that you're charging DHS, I'm trying to figure out how we can, i.e., or even DHS, can have a larger voice in ensuring that that happens. And I think that kind of gets, frankly, to Senator Lori's bill or other ideas out here, because it seems to me that we're wrestling with this issue, Mr. Lights, of making sure that you guys, somehow we really are sure that you got it right now. You know exactly what you need to do, and you're going to move it forward and get it right, and the customer satisfaction is going to be there, and life changes, and counties will be able to manage it. We'll be able to use that platform moving forward to put all the eligibility on it. But at the same time, we don't feel comfortable because your history has not suggested that we should, and the folks that are getting charged for it and have the biggest stake in it have the smallest voice. So I guess, Mr. Lice, if that's a question, I'm just trying to figure out, or maybe even Commissioner Jetson, how can you assure us that we're going down the right road, and do we have enough stakeholders and the right voices in helping to make the decision to ensure that? I don't know if that was a question or just a really long statement, but I'm trying to get my hands around it.
Have at it.
Commissioner Jetson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, let me at least share my perspective at a high level on that, and then I will ask Mr. Lights to comment as well. I think that when it comes, given the history, and I must say that since Mr. Lights joined Mature, he certainly brings a public program perspective to that, and that is we've had a good working relationship, and that has been very helpful. But overall, when we think about governance of the IT system, the Minsure IT system, that I believe that the counties and DHS have to have the overarching voice in that. And I believe that if we want this to be more successful, we need the voice of those kind of frontline people who are going to be who doing the work, kind of the our healthcare eligibility work, the workers of the counties, so that their voices are front and center to make sure that what we build can truly meet the needs of the 91% of the people who are going to go through the system.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, is any of this money going down to the counties to help them with their paperwork? And I literally mean paperwork. It is pen and paper.
Commissioner?
Mr. Deputy Chair and Senator Rosen, the money is going, some of the money is going to, on the IT side, to the improvements that we'll be making during the course of 2015 that we talked about before, which are the improvements the counties are asking us for in the system that will allow them to better manage the public program cases that they're managing now. So that is clearly one of the advantages here is our contribution on the DHS side to that grant that the federal government provided that allows us to do a lot of the improvements or the functionality that simply has not been put into the system yet that needs to be there to properly manage public program cases.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden.
I'd love to hear what Mr. Lights had to say to that. I kind of deflected that that comment. How can we? How can you help this committee be assured that moving forward, that you're going to A, get it right, and B, how can we be assured that the folks that are using the system, the county workers, DHS, the folks that seem to be paying for it, have a greater voice in helping you to make that decision?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, the question around ensuring that there's proper input into it, I think, is an important one. And one of the things that we've worked very hard on over the course of the last year has been to develop mechanisms that are much better in terms of how we're actually managing the build out and what who's at the table in terms of being able to help do that. So we've established a very clear governance process now for that build out of the IT system that actually is chaired by the Department of Human Services by Deputy Commissioner Johnson. So the chair of the group that actually sort of oversees the prioritization is chaired by DHS. We've also added county representation to that steering committee as well. So as we think about the build out moving forward, we've added a process that involves very clearly the Department of Human Services and very clearly the counties, so that we're being very clear in terms of that. We also meet on a every other week basis with a county leadership group, we being this executive steering committee, so that we have all the people around the table who are thinking about the prioritization process, including the Department of Human Services, including MnSure, and including our IT partners, Minute, meets directly with the counties to hear about what their concerns are, where their priorities are. And we take that input very, very seriously in terms of the process. So we've worked hard to put in place those processes. Processes can always be improved, but I think we've come a long way in terms of ensuring that that input is received. I think when we're thinking about the next phase of the build-out and improving many of the things in the system that need to be improved, many of those, I would say the vast majority of those, are very heavily focused on the public program side. Oftentimes there are things on the back end processes or ensuring that we have better ability for counties to be able to access the system. And so the build out to date, I think has gone, the second year has gone much, much more smoothly than the first year did, obviously. But I think we need to make some improvements on the back end. So I think but having that clean input from the counties and from all the parties who are involved in this is something that we focus on very heavily.
And then the last thing,
Senator Hayden.
So just the last question: Does the counties and your various steering committees, do they have how influential are they in terms of who you may pick as a partner to be your vendor for the next phase of the build out? How much influence do they have in that process, in your opinion?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden, they are a partner in the steering committee, which is part of the vendor, which will be part of the vendor selection process. So they're a part of that process.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Brown, Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Leitz, I do want to say you have a very difficult job, and your leadership has turned this ship around to some degree, so I thank you for that. I wouldn't want your job. But when Senator Hayden talked about the counties being involved, I have to think how much involvement are the how much influence are the insurance companies being allowed to give to help turn the ship around too? They have a lot of expertise in this area, and I think we made a mistake at the beginning not allowing them to have more involvement. I'm just wondering where their influence is at this point.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lights. Brown, thanks for that question, because it's an excellent point. The insurers are critical partners, obviously, in all of this. And I don't disagree with your comment that I think they should have been consulted more heavily on the front end when the bill was actually occurring. That didn't occur the way it should have. Fortunately, we've spent the last year working very hard with the insurers to provide points of input. We haven't solved every issue that they've wanted us to solve, I can say that, but I think that they have been highly influential and very helpful in terms of giving us ideas and thoughts around where things should be improved, how they could be improved, and how we could do things differently. Specifically to your question, we meet regularly with them. We have a scheduled weekly call or meeting with the insurers, and then we have in between that biweekly meetings that talk about at an IT level how things are at. But we touch base with them each week and frequently, much more frequently in between. So at a minimum, that's where the input occurs, but it's actually much more frequent than that.
Thank you.
Commissioner Jessen, some additional insights?
If I may just make one addition to what CEO Leitz said about the new governance structure, because I do want to say that I think that since we put this new governance, and so this is for the IT system, governance of the IT system, in place, and that really got finally put in place, probably finalized last summer, that we have seen a much improvement. So on that executive steering committee, I wanted you all to know there are two people from Minsure, including Mr. Leitz, two people from DHS, including Mr. Johnson, two people from Minute, and now we've added one representative from the counties. So, I do feel that has been a real step forward. I also would say that I think another step forward has been Minsure's decision to have vendor relationships managed by Minute. Instead, and so that is much clearer. I think that there were times the vendors would be going, let's try and talk to DHS to get what we want, or Minsure, and I think having that clarity has been helpful as well.
Senator Sharon,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate all of this conversation, but I'm still, and I would really like to hear a clearer answer to what I think Senator Benson is trying to ask. And the answer, if the answer is no, then let's just say that, which means, and I think the question is whether or not it's tested, because the question that Senator Hayden is asking, and the same question is, if it's not tested, then what assurances do we have that continued investment in this is going to create a better outcome? And so I just say, if we're designing our own and getting all these people in the right place to get the right input, but it still is our own system that's specific to our needs and therefore not tested, let's just say that and be clear about that. Because I think Senator Benson's been asking this question for a long time, and it seems to me to be a yes and no answer, and then a justification for why we would prefer to expend some extra resources in order to get it right for us rather than do what might seem logical, which is to use a tested system. So I just want to ask our CEO to give another direct shot at that question.
CEO Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, so let me draw a couple distinctions. When Minsure, the IT system, went live last October, so it'd be October 2013, it had not been tested. The system itself was built almost up to the date that the system went live.
Excuse me, just make sure.
Senator
not tested
Sharon.
Anywhere. Not any state.
Very limited.
Any
test.
World. Anywhere.
Mr. Chair and Senator, Senator Sharon, nearly all of the IT systems that went live last year had very limited testing. They were all new builds. So I want to be clear about that. Regardless of the vendor that was building them, they were built on very short timelines and had very, very limited testing in every state that did it, and frankly at the federal government level as well. And so the systems that were developed, there was no off-the-shelf system that was out there to do an exchange. The ones that came up in various states, there was kind of two models that states followed, either a build from the ground up model or using off-the-shelf software that had been that you modified, so existing software that you modified to do the build. Some states did it one way, some states did it in a different way. We chose in Minnesota to do a model that was using off-the-shelf software and modified to the needs of the Affordable Care Act. So the system itself, when it came up, had very limited testing in any state, but certainly was true here as it went live. And that was a less than ideal circumstance without question. The change that we've made over the course of the last year is that we've built very clearly into our timelines the ability for us to test before we go live with software. That's a change from what it had been, but it's also proven to be successful. We did that this year in the rollout, heading into the open enrollment period. We were able to make changes to the software, improvements to the software, and test those changes in environments so that we knew that the changes that we were making would be stable and that they would work. And in fact, we found that to be the case when people were able to come through this fall and into the open enrollment period, because the situation was simply dramatically better for folks. Moving forward, as we make the changes to the system, those also will be tested. They'll be tested in various environments before they go into what's called production, which is going live with the system. And so, as Commissioner Jessen mentioned, the governance structure for the IT build that we have put in place puts Minute in a very clear role of managing the vendor processes and managing the timelines over which things get put into production. What gets built into that then is Minute is able to actually manage that timeline with the vendors and ensure that we have sufficient testing time built in before things go live into production and people are actually in the system in a live way. So I would say it certainly will be tested. It was tested this year as we went into open enrollment, and the changes that we'll be making to improve the system moving forward will certainly be tested in a much more robust way than the original rollout, 18 months ago was.
So I'm going to kind of summarize the concerns from Senator Benson, Senator Sharon, Senator Brown, Senator Hayden, and myself. I think that, the initial rollout was an incredibly difficult process for everyone involved, including legislators. And there's been some decisions made about how we're going to move forward. And to be honest, the legislature has not been engaged in that. And that's what you're feeling right now. And that's a very uncomfortable place for us. We're, the proposal before us is to increase the public funds. This is on the public program side. I mean, of course, we need to make sure that the QHP side works as well. But on the public program side from DHS, the share that they're picking up is increased. And the legislature feels, myself included, pretty strongly that we need to be included in a much more meaningful way in making sure that that we're making the right decisions going forward. And, I think this is a theme we will probably come back to several times during the course of this legislative session. I mean, we are, at the end of the day, accountable to those who elect us and need to be able to answer these tough questions. And we've all struggled with that. I think, in summary, I think that's what we're feeling right now through this difficult conversation. I don't know if there's another round or if we are ready to move on. We will have more Minsure discussions as we move forward with the session. If members have additional questions, I don't want to shut a conversation down that I think has been helpful. I think we'll move on from here. Thank you very much for that additional insight, and we'll look forward to the follow-up on the budget pieces.
Mr. Chair, the next page I have is page 122. This is the operating adjustment for the central office in the Department of Human Services. Ms. Berry shared a similar pages for direct care and treatment. This proposes a 1.8% increase in the general fund and the healthcare access fund for compensation costs for the agency. Generally, when there are increases in bargaining unit contracts, increases that affect either the cost of living adjustments or healthcare or retirement changes that are made in the legislation that increase the state share of those items, agencies absorb those costs. The legislature last made an appropriation in 2007 to, in a sense, offset some of those costs that agencies are otherwise absorbing. The 1.8% that is used here is a compounded percentage average of what agencies have absorbed over the last 10 years. And it was a number that was worked out with MMB and is being used across agencies for compensation adjustment. For us, for example, in the current biennium, the bargain unit contracts included a 3% COLA both in fiscal year 14 and in fiscal year 15. And for us, that was about $8 million that we absorbed in our budget. And so when we're absorbing those costs, it just necessarily means we're able to do less as we go forward. And so we think this is really critical to putting us in a position to be successful with not all the initiatives that we have on the docket that you have approved over the last several years and that we've been working on diligently to put in place, such as Reform 2020 and the work that we just talked about around MNsure and the Affordable Care Act, our improvements in our fraud work and so forth. And so we think this is a really critical piece for our agency going forward.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
And again, it's being taken out of the Health Care Access Fund. I just want to point that out.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Okay, I didn't catch that on the oversight thing. This is for the share of activities.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen.
Mr. Albright.
The amounts on this page would reflect the 1.8% for currently funded activities in the healthcare access fund. So it would just be their proportionate share of the current activity.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
We're going to have to get into this maybe a little more.
Yeah.
I'm a little confused about this.
And, I was and watching.
About,
yeah, this coal. Sheet. Good catch over on
the coal line increase. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chair, the next topic, I'm going to change gears a little bit here and talk about a couple of proposals in our Office of Inspector General that relate to improvements we're seeking to make in that area. The first is on page 124. This affects the recovery audit contracts that we have in place. Folks may recall recovery audit contracts were a provision that was essentially created or made possible by federal law a number of years ago. Minnesota passed a law in 2011 to position DHS to put these kind of contracts in place. And essentially what this is, it's part of our post-payment review process, how we look at claims that have been paid and try to identify where there may have been overpayments made. And this could be fraudulent, but often it's not. Often it's just some kind of coding difference in opinion about how some activity should be coded, and really allows us to look from a post-payment standpoint about how we attack those. And a number of states have been a little bit ahead of us in doing this. They had set up these contracts to be essentially contracts where the payment to the vendor was based on identified overpayments. We set up our contracts to be on a percentage of collected overpayments. So we're only paying the vendor when we're actually able to collect back on the dollars. And so far under these contracts, we've collected about $3.3 million in overpayments, the state share being about $1.4 million of that, and paid the vendor a share for the piece that they've provided on this. What we're asking for here is two FTEs to help with the process around this. And as you can see, there's more than offsetting savings for the cost of those FTEs in the medical assistance programs from what we expect to be increased collections on overpayments under the RAC contracts. There's a lot of work that goes in from a staff level to identify these overpayments, work on the coding. We're getting appeals from providers that we're managing at the same time. So the two FTEs will help us just to really enhance this activity.
And then a commentary. You know, we funded some in this area last year, and we had to actually pay for them. I like seeing them cover their own costs and produce a little bit of savings. I pushed pretty hard on that last year and didn't quite get there. Senator Brown first. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if you could give a few examples. When you talk about overpayments to providers, what would some examples of that look like? Is it negligence on the part of the provider? Is it ignorance on the part of the provider? If you could just give me some examples so I could get a better idea of what we're talking about.
Inspector Kerber?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office at DHS. Thank you. Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, the recoveries that we've had so far, so the numbers mentioned by Deputy Johnson were it was really $3.3 million that we recovered in calendar year 14. Now, half of that, of course, is federal funding that we give back, and then 11.5% goes to the vendor. But the examples where we really found the most of the money the first time around here was in hospitals. That's where we focus the attention. And it was really on what's called credit balances. And so when the hospital performs a procedure and bills the MA system for reimbursement, we're very quick with our reimbursement to those facilities. They also may be simultaneously billing an insurance company. We're the payer of last resort, and so after the hospital gets the reimbursement from the insurance company, the expectation is that they give that money back to MA. What is MA? And so what we did in this case is we focused on those balances that were more than 6 months old, and that's where we found that the majority of that of those funds that we identified as being due back to the MA fund. There were some others. We looked at some. Our contractor looked at some upcoding issues. Didn't find a lot going on there. Has been looking a little bit at hospital admissions that are not supported by the documentation, where the services could have been provided on an outpatient basis. So we're looking at that. The vendor we've contracted with is the largest in the nation, and they have a lot of experience in this area. But we've been working very closely with them to identify which areas to go into. And these we didn't in 2011 there wasn't a request for a lot of resources to go along with this because we weren't really sure what we were going to find. And so when there is an identified overpayment, then it's our responsibility to verify the accuracy of that and really make that sort of bulletproof in our claim that that's the overpayment. And then we handle all the appeal process. We actually pursue that overpayment, and then any appeals that come back are our responsibility. So we have a lot of activity in this area, and so with a couple more positions, we'll be able to do a better job.
Thank you.
Senator Benchin, did you continue to have a question?
Just briefly, and thank you for bringing this proposal forward. A few years ago, we were talking about analytics, setting up flags. Is that complementary to this, or is this that? Help me straighten that out.
Mr. Chair, Kerber. Senator Benson, that's really one of the benefits of us contracting with the largest business, the largest organization in the business here, is that they have really state-of-the-art data analytics. And so it's really kind of we're really kind of dependent on them, admittedly, because they have the systems in place to do this kind of analysis. And so, you know, we aren't reinvesting in that. We're paying them merely 11%, 11.5% of what's actually recovered. And as was mentioned earlier, it's not based on what they identify. I mean, I think we've all heard from a lot of vendors who will claim to be able to identify a lot of fraud in the system, a lot of overpayments. Well, identifying what might be there is very different than actually recovering those funds. And so it's really a very good investment of our resources to go this route.
So one of the questions I have is, are we pushing the vendor hard enough? I mean, if they're the ones with the technical expertise to go through this, why do we have to hire two FTEs with the technical expertise to analyze the data? Should that be covered by the 11.5% contingency fee that our contractor is getting? I mean, and that would be, and shouldn't, you know, the question would be, yeah, would we be able to get this $200,000 by asking the vendor to work a little harder?
Well, Mr.
Without
Chair,
putting in the FTEs,
I think we're going to continue looking at that. Certainly,
good.
I think as we've got, and I'm sure we will now. as we get into this deeper, you know, it's a learning experience for us, certainly, and you know, we want to make sure that we've got the confidence in the cases brought to us by the vendor, because in the end, it's our costs also defending these claims that we're making. Because the due process costs are ours. And so, and it's really our credibility on the line at the end of the day. And so we are doing some verification of that up front. But if down the road there's an opportunity for us to expect more of that to be done by that vendor, we certainly will do that.
Okay. Senator Carlson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking at one of the lines over here that says MA fraud recoveries. Are we taking it to the point where there might be civil or criminal charges being made, and are we absorbing those legal costs somewhere in the recovery system here? What's happening with that?
Inspector Kerber?
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, when we're dealing with the Medicaid system, there's a federal requirement that at any point we arrive at a conclusion that there may be a credible allegation of fraud represented in the case, then we have the obligation to make a referral to the Attorney General's office. And so we do that on a regular basis from our own investigation, certainly. We haven't had a case from one of these yet where what we were looking at appeared to be fraud. And for it to be fraud, there has to be, you know, intentional deception. And so we haven't had that yet. I mean, what we've had is maybe, not the most attention to bookkeeping methods that seem to result in the favor toward the provider. We haven't seen that yet. But if we do, we will certainly follow up on that.
All right.
Thank you.
Looks like we're ready to move on to the next item.
Mr. Chair, the next item is another Office Inspector General item. It's a background study expansion. There's four distinct expansions of our background studies that we're looking for here. To remind the committee that you passed last year a real expansion and reform of our background study system, which allows us to move forward using fingerprints, being able to access better crimes across the country in the FBI database, as well as having a better capacity for tracking people across as they move between jobs and not having to do as many studies. And this is in part what you're seeing here is built on, in some pieces are built on the fact that we have this new system that allows us to do so much more. The four changes are, the first is a request from Red Lake Nation to do background studies on their nursing facility staff. And again, their interest is now piqued because of our access to the FBI database, because many of the crimes on Red Lake are prosecuted by the federal government, and thus that would be where they'd find those. And so we're able to add additional value to that. The second are some changes to how we would handle expansion doing background studies in other states for MDH-licensed programs, nursing homes, boarding care facilities, and home health agencies. And again, this is a function of our ability now to look across states using the new database access that we have that has piqued the interest here of having those other studies done in other states. And much easier to do the studies in other states with the new system than in the old. We had to do a lot of paper exchange with other states. The third item is doing background studies on the community of sister folks under the MNSHRC contracts. We actually have been doing this work. This is just formalizing it statutorily to say the background studies will be done as part of this and we will perform them. And then the final is related to non-emergency medical transportation. And this is one of the recommendations that come out of the group that's been meeting on NEMT over the last couple of years, that we do background studies on the drivers because they are driving and in contact with vulnerable people. And right now there is no control around what the history behind those drivers is. And this would allow us to have much more control and background studies that would identify if there's any areas of concern for those drivers.
This is interesting. If there are no questions, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move to the portion of the budget pages related to our healthcare administration and ask Assistant Commissioner Nathan Morocco to come back up. As you all know, we have made a lot of investments in healthcare and expansion in the last several years. And I think that what you'll see before you in our healthcare proposals is a much smaller list than in many years past. And I think that is going back to my opening comments, because when we really look at where we've made at the biggest needs, it's really outside of the traditional healthcare system and much more in investments in children and in really bolstering our mental health system. But there are several things in healthcare. We certainly want to address the healthcare access fund issues where questions have come up so that we make sure that we have we're on our path to having a sustainable Minnesota care program. But we also have a couple of proposals that address that address the opioid challenges we have in the state, as well as kind of what we see as some of the needs of our critical access hospitals, which are so important in rural Minnesota. So maybe, Nathan, I'll turn it over to you to walk through the budget pages.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner, and again to the committee. So we'll start with our medical therapy management proposal on page 128. For those that are not familiar with medical therapy management, this is a means of trying to increase the efficacy of the utilization of prescription drugs. So oftentimes it's some type of consultation with the pharmacist. It's a way to improve adherence, to help manage side effects, to help manage perhaps where there's interactions where multiple prescribing doctors are unaware of the combination of drugs that are being taken. So it's sort of another layer within the provider system that helps to create a better level of efficacy around the prescribing of drugs. Under current rules, essentially, MTM is typically targeted at consumers that are using multiple prescriptions. And the threshold at this point is three prescription drugs or more. What we're seeing is that there's likely an advantage to thinking about these kinds of services even when a single drug is being prescribed. An important one that has come up recently is Sovaldi. This is related to hepatitis C treatments. As an example, Sovaldi for an individual prescribing can be upwards of $100,000. We want to ensure that if the state is investing $100,000, that the client understands what the drug is, what the side effects are, how to best manage those side effects, so that we ensure that there's compliance and ultimately efficacy around the treatment itself. So this is really just simply bringing down the threshold under where we would like to see medical therapy management services provided.
If I may add to that, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Jessen.
This is one of these areas where we really are able to, I think, reach more people and help more people by using our pharmacists. We have so many good pharmacists all around our state. And if you think about it, there are lots of folks in greater Minnesota who may have to drive a while to get to see a doctor, but they can get to a pharmacist much more quickly. And so being able to use pharmacists to do more of this counseling, I think, is a huge benefit. And I think it's something, when my discussion with pharmacists around the state, something they're very interested in doing as well.
You know, on several of the change items that I was reviewing, these next three for largely opioid and controlling of prescriptions and whatnot, some of the results and the measures in here are kind of backwards looking, and I'm kind of interested in what we're going to see going forward. It's kind of another in the weeds question that we will get to when we actually see the budget pages and see the fiscal notes associated with this. But if we're going to actually see a reduction in the ER use, I'd like to be able to look forward and see what we're going to get from this and actually be able to get a better handle on what the cost savings are. So if you look at these results, they kind of end with where, and most of these change items, they end with where we are today, where we've been and where we end today. And I think that when we're talking about making an investment, one of the things that many of us are interested in is, well, where does this investment bring us tomorrow? And so these metrics haven't been particularly helpful in looking into the future and seeing what the benefits are. The costs give us some clue as to what you're expecting, and we will see more when we get the fiscal notes. But that's just a recurring theme and one that I had noted on this one as I was going through. So,
yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could comment on that.
Please do.
It's an excellent point and certainly something we're very interested in calculating as well. Of course, when you get into areas of cost avoidance, that can be tricky, admittedly.
Yes.
But even as an example, in this proposal, we're going to serve what we're estimating to be 1,300 more clients under this MTM program, and where the savings comes in of $41,000 and $78,000 is really in the avoiding of adverse drug usage. So we certainly are looking at that, and you'll see that I think in some of our other proposals where we are trying to recognize that sometimes there's a cost, might be a vendor cost, might be an FTE cost, but then trying to understand both being able to calculate the savings and trying to estimate when those savings are going to occur. Are there short-term gains? Are we looking, you know, in the 1 to 2 year time frame, or right. are we looking out in the next biennium, or, you know, perhaps even in some cases even a 10-year road? So your point is very well taken. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, my question was sort of answered, which raised another question. So we're scoring savings going forward. Did you look back at ER visits and say, okay, if we had had counseling on through medication therapy management services, we can look back for the last 3 years in our MA population and say, okay, these people would have been helped, or this category of people would have been helped? Is that how? And I don't mean to get into the weeds. We can have an offline discussion, but I think it's interesting. We're projecting savings going forward, but we're not well informed as to what the historic costs have been of not having this system. So, again, in the weeds, but
yeah, well, maybe in a little bit of MTM was, you know, initially started as a fairly small pilot, and you needed I think it was 6 prescriptions and 3 chronic conditions, and it produced significant savings in helping a patient coordinate through the advice of the pharmacist. And it's been changed over the years so that it's now, I think, 3 prescriptions and 1 chronic condition. And this would take it, and it has continued to show savings. Of course, your largest savings are in those most involved patients. But I think that it has been incredibly beneficial, and recognizing the value of the pharmacist in the interdisciplinary healthcare team is one of the learnings that we've had out of that. But then, you know, this is a new population, when I saw Sovaldi with the Hep C, you know, and cost savings, that's not typically the narrative that comes out when you start talking about Sovaldi, booking savings for Hep C. Advancements in medication therapy is a little bit of a new frame. So we'll have some conversations about that. It's been a matter of some concern over people watching budgets. I mean, it has some fairly significant fiscal implications depending on how it's handled. So, Senator Sharon.
Thank you. This is just a little off on this, so you can cut me off or we can talk about it later. But that causes me to think about, especially when you refer to cost containment initiatives or efforts to, in this case, it's to improve the patient's understanding of the interaction of medications and what and also maybe even the physician who's prescribing them might become aware of something. But I've been hearing a concern, and I think you're aware, Mr. Morocco, about what happens to people if they have to go through frequent every 30-day prior authorization processes. And why are we doing that? When are we doing that? Because what I'm hearing is that what we might be doing because it's a more expensive drug or it's not on our register for allowed drugs are creating difficulties for families whose children are on serious medications that they need to contain a seizure disorder or some obviously chronic long-term disease that's been managed with a certain recommended treatment, and they have to keep coming back for prior authorization, which delays their access to the medication when they can't afford it themselves. And so, you know, could you speak to that, if not now, soon? Because this has been an issue that this is about the second round that I brought it up, and it's not been resolved.
Commissioner Morocco?
Mr. Chair, and Senator, yeah, I mean, I think certainly the point that you raise is a good point, and that's always the balance that we have to strike. I think there, in some ways, there are complements to trying to solve the same problem. Typically, prior auth is really focused more on the provider sort of medical side, and MTM is focused more on the pharmacy side. But ultimately, both trying to accomplish similar things. Although I would say that MTM is almost trying to layer on top of the medical side, a better level of coordination than might exist within a medical environment. So a prior auth is about ensuring that the right drug is being prescribed, that it's being prescribed in over periods of time that have, you know, through medical opinions, is being deemed sort of appropriate checkpoints. And it may be there for several reasons. It may be there because it's trying to manage cost. It could be a very expensive drug. It could be because that the patient, that they want the interaction with the patient to occur more frequently. So I think prior auths try to accomplish a lot of different things. So it would be, so I can't necessarily give you a blanket answer, but I think we could sort of go condition by condition or prescription by prescription and talk about, you know, what is prior auth trying to accomplish. And then I think it's a good discussion to have as to whether or not it's actually creating barriers or to care, or actually lessening the effectiveness of care, as opposed to doing what it's trying to accomplish, which is either to, you know, improve the care or contain the cost. So yeah, that would sort of be my general comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is exactly what the issue is. I understand department and our interest in cost savings by inappropriate use of medication, but feedback we're getting is that while we might be achieving some of that, we're creating problems for people with chronic illnesses that need consistency and stability in their medication. This is true in psychiatric disorders as well. And so I need to have a dive into how to get rid of that negative consequence while retaining some of the benefits that we're trying to achieve.
Yep.
Okay. That's all I have to say now.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'll direct you to page 130. This is our opioid prescribing improvements and monitoring program. Just for some background, at any time our data indicates that there's 19,000 chronic opioid users within the healthcare plans here at the state. And so what we're proposing is we would like to work with the community to try to come to some understanding, community standards, sort of best practices, best approach on how we're going to address this issue. So what we'd like to do is develop a set of measurements that will indicate, you know, where variances might occur and how we can really improve the overall opioid use. We have spent the better part of the last 12 months really working with the community already on this, working with the medical directors at the health plans, working with organizations like the Institute for Clinical Studies Improvement, or ICSI, trying to figure out how as a community we can address and approach opioid issues. We'd like to see there be some sort of education campaign for providers to create more awareness around this issue. So the cost that you're seeing, $33,000 in fiscal year 16 and 17, and $42,000 in 18 and 19, really what those costs are going to is a 1.5 FTE, and then we are assuming that there is an offset to that in savings and the reduction or misuse of opioid drugs. So.
Oh, Commissioner, sorry.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering if it would be possible to skip ahead a little bit. I'm concerned, since I do have to leave because I have all this 11 o'clock meeting with the governor, and I had told Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman that I would do his slide on our continuing care for older adults, and I know that Mr. Coleman couldn't be here, and I know Assistant Commissioner Rocco and Johnson can do the rest of the health care ones fine, but would that be possible to...
You know, could we do the related one, the restricted recipient program?
Oh,
I think is related to these last two. We can do that one quick, and then there'd be a good segue. Is that? I think you have enough time.
Oh, I do. I just wanted to make sure.
We'll do that.
That would be great.
Okay.
Restricted recipient.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So I'll direct you to page 133. So the intent of this program is to identify Medicaid recipients who have excessive use in the program. It could be, that they're overutilizing services. There could be drug-seeking behavior that's occurring. They're shopping around for answers, shopping around for, you know, for products and services. And so this program is essentially intended to identify those folks and then direct them into more specific single, primary care physician, so that there is someone who is aware of their conditions and can better manage and restrict this excessive usage. So this ensures that the Medicaid recipient only utilizes services that are medically necessary. And so the cost here, which is an investment in three staff, and it'll produce over $500,000 in savings, $519,000 in this biennium, and overall about $1 million in savings over the next biennium.
And this is an expansion of a successful
that's correct.
Project within the department. Senator Hayden?
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. So I can appreciate the work that we're doing to identify the opioid users are those that are drug-seeking or are getting medication that they don't need because they've now developed an addiction. And maybe today, or maybe this slide isn't the right question to ask, but there has to be then a connection to those then seeking treatment and rehabilitation from the addiction that they've developed. So how does those two interplay? So I can appreciate we don't want people to get more than they have. We want to look at the prescribers, make sure they're not prescribing, make sure the folks that are getting them aren't getting them when they're supposed to. But then if they don't get it and there's no other intervention, then we actually then go into this issue of them seeking it in places that aren't regulated, and then we have that. So then obviously that the next track is they go to heroin, and then we start dealing with the social consequences of that. We had a bill last year to do the Narcan and other things for those exact folks. So is there an interplay between the cost savings that goes into the consolidated treatment fund, or what is our strategy now that we've identified, found them, restricted them, but they still are addicted?
Mr. Morocco, Commissioner Jessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden. That's a really good question, and I think what Assistant Commissioner Morocco is talking about is a couple of the things we're doing, as you pointed out, on one side, trying to have better prescribing so we have program so that we're restricting the inappropriate use of prescription drugs, which, as you pointed out, can often lead to heroin. There are a couple of other proposals we have in different parts of the budget that address the treatment issue. One of the big ones, and this may have been when you weren't in the committee at that exact moment, Senator Hayden, but one of the big initiatives is really our work with tribes for women who are pregnant and addicted, and to have this initiative to have integrated care and really get our arms around those pregnant moms so that we have better outcomes. And that really gets to what we talked about. It's just this huge increase in the number of babies that are born with opioids in their systems. So that's one of our big initiatives. Another one is I think what you're describing really relates to why we think that there are some individuals that have really high needs in our chemical dependency system, and we're proposing an increased rate for providers, both within our care system but also for private providers, so they could get this increased rate if they're certified to be able to serve some of these particularly hard to treat individuals. So we're trying to do things on a couple of different fronts when it comes to addiction.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, wouldn't this be easier if we did have the electronic prescription monitoring program also in place?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, certainly we support strengthening the prescription monitoring program. You know, I think that's something that's really in the Board of Pharmacy's, jurisdictional bailiwick, but something that I strongly support.
Okay. All right. Commissioner Jessen, okay. Guide us to where you'd like to cover.
I'm just going to speak briefly about, and this is on the change items are pages 143 to 145, and these are the items that come out of our continuing care for older adults. This is an area that Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman, who I believe you all know well, is heading up for us. We have made a lot of investments in the last several years in our long-term care, and we're implementing Reform 2020, have increased rates, including with quality measures, launched Own Your Own Future, which not all of you may have heard about, but that is really our first. I wanted to step back as it really relates to one of our proposals and describe this, and that is an effort to get people to plan for their long-term care. Some of that planning is having hard conversations conversations with your family about what you want, but also to do financial planning for families that are able to do that. So we did kind of a PR part. We've got a great pamphlet if y'all want them. We have a website. We're really working with the long-term care industry as well as the financial industry as well as consumers about what we can do to do this. But we have the second phase of this Own Your Own Future, which is also saying, look, we don't have enough products out there that are widely available that people know about for middle-income Minnesotans to be able to save for some of their long-term care. And as many of you all know, the Affordable Care Act, one of their provisions was to kind of have a starter long-term care program, the CLASS Act, and that wasn't actually sound and faltered. And so that's where we thought we need to step in and look at this, just given the age wave that we have talked about so much. So we had a really good panel of experts look at, together with our Commerce Department, what are some options that are out there. And I'd love to at some point have more time to spend with you all looking at that. But I, because I think there are a number of things we can explore and a lot, but we brought forward in the governor's budget two of those proposals from our Own Your Own Future campaign. And one would be just to have it's really kind of a clearinghouse, one place for information where people could go and learn about financial tools that are available. Now, we would not sell these. This would not be an exchange. We would have links to kind of brokers and others about this. But there's no one place to go. And one of the things our panel learned is there actually are some financial things available that people just don't know about, you know, but that are being licensed to being sold already in Minnesota. So we think this would be so part of our proposal, and it's would be to at least enable us to put that together, much like we do our senior linkage line. Kind of that sort of place where they're not promoting one product, but they're there for information, and I think a valuable set of objective information. And the second item from the Own Your Own Future campaign's suggestions that we would like to have money, and I think this is around $100,000, to just explore is a product that we had a lot of interest in but it's not available yet. We want to look and see if we could make this work. So that would be a product which you would buy when you were maybe you're 25 or 30, you're starting to have a family, and you're thinking, look, I need life insurance, because we know we do, especially when thinking of our kids. So the first maybe 25 years of your life would be term life. But then as you grow older, it would at least be some sort of long-term care benefit. It's probably not going to cover everything, but at least we know that, you know, most 70% of us are going to need some sort of long-term care help. For many of us, it may be just the chore service or some, you know, home health aides coming into our homes. So that at least to be able to see if we could develop a product that like along those lines, which I think could have appeal. And I think obviously it's important. So these are just a couple of the proposals. It's a starting of a conversation, but I do think we need to look at different financial models that are available to middle-income Minnesotans to deal with the age wave. And the other part of this smarter purchaser approach to long-term care is a home and community-based services innovation pool. So I think many of you all are aware of in our healthcare purchasing for our basic healthcare, we are really entering into new models. We're trying to provide more incentives for providers who meet our goals on, for our population health, healthcare goals, but can save money, then they could share in those savings and even sometimes take some risk on. And we have 165,000 people in our Medicaid population now that are under one of those sorts of arrangements where we're really trying to change the incentives for providers to really focus on our goals and also being more efficient. And this is something that is we want to explore more in our long-term care area as well. And we've been approached by several good providers that are interested in some new arrangements. But it's not the sort of thing that you want to just say, okay, let's try it on everyone. So we'd like to have an innovation pool of money where we can have providers through an RFP process say we'd like to move to, it's kind of like a pay-for-performance. We want to move folks that want to be moving out of perhaps group homes into their own apartments or maybe into more competitive with supports employment. Well, then let's pay let's have bonuses or extra money or withholds and additional money to reward those sorts of outcomes, which we know are good for people, but also in the long term are produced savings to the state. It's just a small amount of money. The total of these three things would be $3.3 million in the next biennium, but we believe we need to test out some of these new models to really see what could work moving forward.
Okay. Senator Benson?
And very quickly, as I know the commissioner needs to leave, I appreciate you looking at long-term care. I'm a little concerned, different than the linkage line, which helps you sort of plan your long-term care and aging services work, a little concerned about the state getting into sort of recommending financial products or providing guidance on financial products. So I'd like to see this a bit more fleshed out, but I think generally on the right track. So,
and
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, we will flesh this out more because we do not want to be recommending particular products.
Yep.
We want to be really clear about that.
I think the design of a product that could function like that, though, is kind of innovative. I mean, as our insurance needs change as we age, you know, maybe if somebody's interested in something, but your concern is absolutely valid.
Mr. Chair, it wasn't so much the insurance product she was talking about, because we have the purview to set up insurance in Minnesota according to our rules. The guidance that we would be providing in long-term care, if we're referring people to financial advisors and things like that, I just want to be cautious.
Okay.
Thank you.
And
Mr. Chair,
with your indulgence, I'm going to step out now, and perhaps Deputy
yep.
Commissioner Chuck Johnson could cover the other item on this page.
Sure. That's great. Thank you for the amount of time you committed to us, Commissioner Jessen. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, members.
And so you're going to cover the other?
Okay. Yeah, so.
So before we get off of this one, though, just a comment about tone, kind of changing the hearts and minds of how we approach Olmstead. As I was reading this one, a word just jumped out at me. For long-term care purchasing, the state needs to find ways to promote specific interventions for directing people with disabilities. That directing just is, we need to change that mentality. We need to, all of Olmstead is about respecting individuals' choices and their needs, and it's not about directing them. I think that's sort of a history that has plagued us, and that is a remnant that I saw, and I really stumbled over it, and I just felt the need to flag that and make sure that we ingrain that in how we think about things, and that it's a small thing, this one word on the page, but I think it's important and needs to be flagged. So just that one editorial.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Duly noted, and I think a great observation.
Great.
So, Mr. Chair and members of the committees, we'll go back to page 135. This is a proposal related to inpatient hospital payment changes. Just as a refresher, if you remember last year, we had talked about rebasing, and under rebasing, there really are sort of two categories of hospitals. One would be the critical access hospitals and the other being the remaining hospitals. During that, as part of that rebasing process, we really keep those two buckets of providers and the money involved in the rebasing process. There will be more information coming out at the end of February, sort of into March, about what we're doing relative to the other hospitals. This one is specific, though, to the critical access. So this is more of an access issue for us than even a payment issue, in that we want to ensure that we have the critical access to the critical access hospitals. The methodology that's used for the other types of hospitals where there's a much higher volume of patients being served, so the tools and sort of the options that we have in that arena don't transfer as well over to the critical access hospitals. So what we're really talking about here is trying to move to a different methodology. This is a Medicare really based on Medicare costs. And we believe it allows for a more stable payment structure. And again, more of this will come out, and I think it'll be an easier comparison once you see sort of what the recommended policies are for the other hospitals compared to this group. So it's a bit of a challenge to have this discussion kind of, you know, without the broader context of all hospitals. But I think what you will see is that, again, the tools for the other types of hospitals where they have the higher volume and there's broader breadth of patients, that it just doesn't translate well over. So this is, and in addition, there's also the ability here for us to redistribute on the disproportionate share hospital payments. Again, this does kind of get into the weeds and a little bit tricky to have in isolation just to the critical access. But in essence, what this proposal does is ensure that we don't have money leaving the system. So to the extent that some hospitals are reaching the limits on their DSH payments, we want to find ways to have those monies that would have other been eligible to those hospitals, if not for reaching the limit. We'd like to find ways to have that money circulate back to other hospitals so that we're not essentially leaving money on the table. So the cost of this proposal is $5.2 million in fiscal year 16 and 17 and $6.8 million in 18 and 19.
I was interested, and we'll see more when we get the language, but the adjustments to the critical access, is this a real change? I mean, we had made a decision to, you know, leave critical access as a cost-based methodology based on the cost reports, and what I read here is that you found a lot more variation in cost than you were anticipating, and so you want some changes, some flexibility to take a different approach with the critical access that we had decided to set aside and just do that cost-based, and there's little detail here to help us get behind
right
what that might look like.
Right. Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's a great example. So, you know, under the current methodology, we might see a variance related to cost of being 20% to cost to 80% of cost in terms of what's being reimbursed. So if you were to take a similar methodology that we're trying to apply to other hospitals and just sort of try to average that out, then that means you're going to end up with some hospitals gaining upwards of 30 to 40 percent on cost, but conversely having some of the critical access hospitals losing 30 to 40% of the cost. So sort of the winner-loser scenario becomes very extreme and much more extreme than what we would see in other kinds of hospitals where, again, the severity is much more similar across the hospitals. They're seeing many more patients. They're providing a much more diverse set of services. So there tends to be a more balancing as a result of just the sheer volume. When you get into critical access, you could be seeing very few patients, and to the extent that one is highly severe and one is not, it creates these very dramatic swings if you were to try to apply the same methodology that we're doing under rebasing or to simply go with the old cost structure. So again, I understand this is a difficult conversation to have without the broader context. There is a report that's coming out in mid-March that really talks about our approach to rebasing, and the intent of that report is to allow the legislature to understand what we're recommending on a broader level, you know, how we want to approach rebasing, what are the various policy levers that we're recommending, and you know, ultimately to inform the legislature so they can decide how they want to emphasize payments, whether it be around mental health, whether it be around children. And so, again, this is really just trying to change the methodology for critical access so that it's based on Medicare rates, which, again, we believe is a more stable methodology. And while it is an issue about rates, ultimately, we really see this as more of an access issue for greater Minnesota. That's why we're coming with this particular proposal. So, anyway, Mr. Chair.
We'll learn more as we move forward.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I would assume we'd have the runs on the hospitals, critical access hospitals, that will be affected.
I was going to ask this report that you'll have out in mid-March, will it include runs of what your current modeling looks like?
Absolutely.
It will.
But Mr. Chair, so the idea of the report is that it will contain what will be what will be implemented, but not, but certainly subject to change, you know, if the legislature chooses to do something different. But it would, in essence, be what we would be implementing, and again, as I talked about, with our recommended policy adjusters, but creating a transparency, a full transparency to legislature, so that you have the opportunity, if you should disagree with how those rates were set, the policy adjusters that were used, you know, how various components were weighted, you certainly then would have that opportunity to establish something different.
That's going to be fun.
All right.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, then I would direct you to page 137. This is an improvement on third-party liability recoveries. You know, as you're probably aware, you know, Medicaid obviously is a form of coverage, but oftentimes clients can have secondary coverage. This is simply asking for ways to improve on the recovery when other coverages do exist. This proposal helps us to more effectively collect on the third-party liabilities that might be out there, and really reducing sort of the pay and chase that occurs out there in the industry. It's largely targeted to towards really third parties that are outside of the state. Obviously, those within the state, it's pretty clear there's only a few players that are involved, and it's a pretty tight community. So knowing where other coverage might exist and how to access that coverage is more well known. It's when you get into it's when you get outside of Minnesota that it becomes more of a challenge. So really what we're asking for is that these third parties are required to give us better data, so when we become aware that third-party coverage may exist, we can make that request, and it obligates these insurers to provide that information within 90 days. Again, this is really about trying to tightening up our ability to identify and then also work with these with these third parties. It does change some of the timing requirements as well. So again, not only are we asking for these third parties to obligate them to respond back to us, but to also do in a timely manner, and we're asking for that within 90 days. We're also asking on the back end for reconciliation that there may be claims that come back to the state where a third party believes that they are not accountable or liable for a certain claim. Sometimes those claims can come in years after the services actually have been provided. So we're asking to tighten that up, and so that there's a two-year window where a third party would come forward to Medicaid and ask for compensation on something they don't believe to be their liability. So really, we're sort of tightening up on the front and the back end as you sort of chase these claims from a third party perspective. There's not a lot of incentive to work with us on the front end and to identify where third party liability exists. But on the back end, there's a lot of incentive for them to continue to be aggressive about finding ways to not have to pay for claims and to put that on Medicaid. So on the front end, we're asking, we want better identification, and we need these vendors to work with us in a reasonable time frame, 90 days. And on the back end, we're asking, you know, for these vendors to identify within 2 years if they believe this liability exists or doesn't exist, for them to work with us within a two-year period of time. So the net savings, I don't recall if I went through the numbers, but it's $1.9 million in fiscal year 16 and 17 and $2.7 million in 18 and 19.
This is probably going to be the last topic we're going to be able to cover today. Apologies. It's always difficult to try to manage a conversation. Are you able to come back tomorrow morning and cover the last two items?
Absolutely.
Then we have a couple of minutes if members want to ask some questions about this. I have one. I notice this is a cost recovery component and a cost avoidance component.
Correct.
We don't. Is the savings just the cost recovery piece? Because we typically don't book savings for cost avoidance issues.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I can maybe reframe it and see if this answers your question. So our ability to identify, obviously, third party on the front end would limit our liability. So the claims that we are paying today would move to a third party. And then on the back end, we would have less claims coming in from the third party, indicating that they believe Medicaid is accountable for a claim. So that's where the savings comes on the front end and the back end. Did I answer your question, or
Well, we'll have to have the fiscal folks dig into that a little bit, because it does sound like there's a booking of savings for cost avoidance from that answer, and we'll have to make sure that we're tracking everything correctly, and we'll that's way into the weeds. We can have offline conversations about that. Thank you very much, and so we will finish up the last two items tomorrow, and then we'll move on and do all of MDH. Again, public testimony money on Tuesday, boards and councils on Wednesday. We'll be back in room 107. Health and Human Service Finance Division is adjourned.
No answers. They don't have